families are looking for their loved ones and seeing if they can identify the face. So those graves are being repeatedly dug up.
Several demonstrators now are taking the banner, "Civilians and Children Die for Lockheed Martin Profits," and holding it up against the brisk winds on Lockheed Martin property now.
Women bring a different power. They bring a power of resistance that comes from a value of what you have and what you are.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Wednesday, April 16th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The Bush administration lowered the national terror alert level to yellow today, saying the end of heavy fighting in Iraq has reduced the threat of terrorist attacks. Some security measures around the country will be relaxed, according to officials. It was unclear whether the heightened alert had prevented any terrorism. Looking beyond a war in Iraq that is winding down, President Bush said today Saddam Hussein's regime has passed into history and called on the United Nations to lift the crippling economic sanctions against Baghdad.
Now that Iraq is liberated, the United Nations should lift economic sanctions on that country. We're also addressing Iraq's urgent medical problems. Problems left by a regime that built palaces in a country that needed hospitals. It will take time to build the institutions of democracy and the habits of freedom. The Iraqi people are reclaiming their own streets, their own country, and their own future. Yesterday, an historic gathering occurred in the city of Al-Nasiriyah, where Iraqis met openly and freely to discuss the future of the country. They even had some protesters outside the meeting, a sure sign of freedom.
Bush declared the military mission a success without actually declaring the war over. A shooting in this northern city left 3 Iraqis dead and 17 wounded today, a day after U.S. troops killed at least 7 people when they opened fire, a commander said, to keep an angry crowd from storming a government complex. Hospital officials put yesterday's death toll at 14. The U.S. Central Command in Qatar said around 7 were killed. The discrepancy could not be reconciled. The cost of the war in Iraq to the citizens of Iraq can be counted literally in bodies. The number of civilian casualties continues to grow as medical supplies and water and electricity is still out in the major cities. Dr. April Hurley, a family physician from Santa Rosa, California, spent the last several weeks in Baghdad, going from hospital to document for herself the victims of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Peace Watch caught up with Dr. Hurley today in Amman, Jordan, and asked what moved her to leave her lucrative practice and go to Baghdad.
I couldn't stand the idea of staying and watching my government do what it was threatening to do to these people. And I just couldn't stay home in the comfort of my home and my television and watch those talking heads talk about collateral damage like it was nothing, like it was a military strategy, a military term. Mm-hmm. People's lives were expendable.
Oftentimes when we hear that term used by the military, collateral damage, it's a reference to innocent civilians who have been killed as a result of errant bombs on the part of the U.S. or Britain or just
or
in general.
In this case, military targets were in neighborhoods. They knew they were going to kill civilians anytime they hit a military target, just about every military target. And it wasn't that these people were put in danger, not to say that didn't happen, but these people mostly were civilians in their homes and they couldn't afford to leave and they had no choice. And they were sitting ducks to our bombing. And that is against Geneva Convention and our soldiers don't even know that.
You were there in the hospitals. Tell us about your experience there.
I got to see. I went to hospitals. Even with the bombing, you would get around and do things because mostly the bombing was at night.
What kind of injuries were you seeing as a result of this massive bombing campaign?
I saw lots of kids with shrapnel injuries to their abdomen. A lot of kids with colostomy bags. A lot of kids that were going to need surgery to reanastomose their bowels where they had been operated on. These kids, and spleen and liver lacerations, and people on ventilators, and people with amputated hands, limbs, huge, huge wounds, head wounds, comas. We saw the whole gamut. And then the hospitals also took pictures of the dead that would come in. And so I saw those pictures too. So it was horrendous because it was so many civilians and so many kids. You know, Baghdad is half kids. It's teeming with kids, little kids mostly. And they were most of the victims. So it was horrendous. Mm. And then when the telephones went out and people couldn't get emergency care, it was worse. I mean, people were not able to survive their injuries. Even relatively straightforward, simple injuries, they'd bleed to death at the scene, or there just wasn't any paramedics to help.
Were you there, Dr. Hurley, when the statue of Saddam Hussein was pulled down by the U.S. military troops with the tank in the square?
Well, I hope you all know that that was staged, and that was pretty interesting. If you looked at the aerial view of those scenes, it was clearly not a lot of people doing those statues, and the military was very much involved. The people that were doing the statues were shipped in from the Shiite areas of Baghdad, where they're very much against the Saddam Hussein regime, and they were very much for the military invasion and occupation. So they were all fired up to do that statue thing. But there wasn't that many. And it's true that the people did actually greet the soldiers, greet the Marines, in a warm way. That's the way they are. And they also appreciated the end to the bombing, and they appreciated the end to the regime. But that cooled off very quickly, especially when the looting started. And some of the looting was encouraged by the Marines, and people would have come up to us and tell us their experiences, what they saw, just to make sure that we were clear that it wasn't strictly Iraqi Baghdad residents.
Well, can you expound on that?
I'm sorry?
Can you expound on that when you say that some of the looting was encouraged by the Marines?
Well, sometimes the Marines would blow away the windows and doors of a building, like a bank, and welcome people in to loot it. And I think, I can't say this for sure because this is secondhand, but I was told that a Marine who was questioned about that commented that the victims had benefited from the government all these years and they deserved the looting. So
the victims had benefited from the government?
The victims of, whoever was the owner of the business or the bank or the government building.
I see.
Were government dole individuals, therefore they deserved it. And so the looting was encouraged, at least a good part of it was, some of it was, or at least some of the initiation was, and a lot of it, too, were other nationalities that were in the city anticipating this kind of chaos.
Did you Dr. Hurley, personally witness any incident with a Marine, or you said that was secondhand information for you?
Actually, that was secondhand, but we had the Marines at the hotel in our area, in our neighborhood, with that Saddam Hussein statue incident, because that was right near the Palestine Hotel. We're near the Palestine Hotel. And after that incident with the statue being pulled down, the Marines pretty much occupied that whole complex area of hotels. Palestine, Sheraton, our hotel. We had Marines.
Right, but did you personally witness any Marines encouraging looting?
No, I didn't. But it was people I knew, some of the team, that told me, some of the Iraq peace team, that people had walked up to the vehicle that they were in and said, "Excuse me, who are you? And I need to tell you this because your soldiers did this. I saw them do it."
I'm reading an article from the Common Dreams website that speaks about, and it's written by Kathy Kelly, one of the human rights workers there in Baghdad, and she's with your team.
She's the Iraq peace team.
She says nurses are digging graves in front of the Al-Mansour Hospital in Baghdad.
You know what's sadder than that, Verna? Sadder than that is that there's no markers on those graves. So those graves are being dug up. Families are looking for their loved ones and seeing if they can identify the face. So those graves are being repeatedly dug up by families looking for people. And the mosques are reciting names of people in case somebody can identify that they saw them, that they're still alive.
Dr. April Hurley, a family physician from Santa Rosa, California, speaking with us from Amman, Jordan, after leaving Baghdad, Iraq. Hurley will be returning to the U.S. tomorrow and will ride Amtrak from Chicago, Illinois, to Santa Rosa, California for 2 days, talking with people about the war in Iraq and spreading the word of her personal experiences in Baghdad. The halls and display rooms of Iraq's museums are still littered by the ruins left by looters and plunderers. Law enforcement officials and museum curators are rushing to assess and document the damages. Many groups are criticizing the U.S. military's failure to protect Iraq's relics. Amnesty International Secretary General Irene Khan said that coalition forces were in breach of the Geneva Convention, which requires occupying forces to take responsibility for security and humanitarian affairs. Peace Watch commentators Ralph Shulman and Maya Schoen offer these thoughts on the matter.
Anything and everything goes. The Washington Post reported in detail how the liberation of Iraq became the plundering of Baghdad, with thousands of looters ransacking every hospital, the vast industrial parks on the south side of the capital, highways becoming shopping aisles as they wheeled, dragged, carried, and drove away, booty ranging from cars to card tables, everywhere. Baghdad's colleges of nursing and engineering, the Al Sadir Hotel, the ministries of education and industry, everything plundered.
Khalid Bayomi, in an interview with Sweden's largest newspaper, gives insight. He reports that U.S. soldiers instigated the plunder. U.S. soldiers in four tanks shot two Sudanese guards who stood at their posts outside a local administration building. Then they blasted apart the doors to the building, and from their tanks they called out in Arabic, encouraging people to go and take what they wanted. Bayomi continues, afterwards they went to the Justice Department and then to a neighboring building, and the plundering continued there. Are you saying that it was U.S. troops who initiated the plundering? He was asked. Absolutely, declared Bayomi.
A civilization torn to pieces, Robert Fisk describes. They lie across the floor in tens of thousands of pieces, the priceless antiquities of Iraq's history, the looters going from shelf to shelf, systematically pulling the statues, the pots, the amphorae of Assyrians, Babylonians, the Sumerians, the Medes, the Persians, and the Greeks, hurling them on the concrete, the wreckage of 5,000-year-old marble plinths and stone statuary. But what is most extraordinary about this detailed report of a devastation of an entire civilization and culture is how Fisk describes his appeal to the American commanders to take action, which they absolutely refused to do.
Insight is given again about U.S. plans to loot the Iraqi antiques. It appeared in the Sunday Herald on April 7th in an article by Liam McDougall. A coalition of antiquities collectors and arts lawyers calling itself the American Council for Cultural Policy met with U.S. Defense and State Department officials prior to the invasion of Iraq. What they were asking for was to change Iraq's laws, which maintains antiquities in the country. What they wanted was to make it easier for the antiquities to be dispersed to the United States.
And John Burns describes in the Washington Post how the fundamental looting of the treasures was done by merchants who knew exactly where to go, maps in hand, keys to vaults, keys to safes, the great gold artifacts, the most valued of the treasures, literally stolen by design with foreknowledge, as the curator of the museum confirmed. And indeed, throughout southern Iraq, the Financial Times reports that a little-known Iraqi militia called the Iraqi Coalition of National Unity has taken over the southern towns with U.S. Special Forces. The people of the southern area described themselves as terrified as the looting was organized in a systematic way by the so-called Iraqi militia and the special forces in town after town in southern Iraq.
It's important to note that the Iraqi Coalition of National Unity was trained by the U.S. military at a special base in Hungary.
So what we have here is the preparation for the imposition of draconian colonial rule and the deflection of attention away from the slaughter of the civilian population, which has brought thousands of dismembered bodies to hospitals overwhelmed without anesthesia or antibiotics. It is that that is being concealed. It is the plundering on a huge scale, preparing for the oil plunder to follow. This is Ralph Schoenman.
And Maya Schoen.
Well, seeking to tone down the Bush administration's hawkish rhetoric towards Syria, Secretary of State Colin Powell said yesterday that although the Bush administration has expressed concerns about Syrian actions, it has no plans for military moves at the present time. But as Aaron Glantz reports from Amman, Jordan, many in the region are still concerned that the American tanks that rolled into Baghdad will turn northwest towards Damascus.
Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon told an Israeli newspaper yesterday Syrian President Bashar al-Assad is dangerous because he opposed the U.S. war on Iraq and is, quote, capable of making the same error over the balance of forces with Israel he made with the Americans. While the vast majority of Arabs throughout the Middle East oppose peace with Israel, the Syrian government is alone among Israel's immediate neighbors in rejecting the Bush administration's so-called roadmap for peace in the Middle East. Basil Burgan is a politically active businessman in Amman, the capital of Jordan.
If there is going to be a solution for the Arab-Israeli problem or the Palestinian-Israeli problem, any country like Syria has to be controlled and stopped. So this is one of the things that they are doing. And I think they're sending a message, not just to Syria, to all Arab governments, telling them, you know, this is what has happened in Iraq could happen in your country. So we have plans and don't stand against our plans.
In recent days, American officials have intensified their war rhetoric against Syria, accusing the Ba'athist dictatorship of Bashar Assad of sheltering fleeing Iraqi officials, developing weapons of mass destruction, and harboring Palestinian militants committed to violence against the State of Israel. Syrian officials have shot back, saying their country is ready to immediately sign and implement an accord banning weapons of mass destruction from the entire Middle East. Neither Syria nor Israel admits to possessing weapons of mass destruction, but both countries are known to have large stockpiles of chemical weapons, and Israel is known to possess an arsenal of more than 200 nuclear warheads, most of them stationed in the country's southern Negev desert. Jamal Tahad is an independent political analyst based in Amman.
I think Syria will try to play this card very well, that it's not like Iraq and Syria regime never used these weapons of mass destruction. And I think Israel, the first country in this region who tried to get weapons of mass destruction. And in this counterbalance, Syrians feel that it's not just to come and ask Syria to be, you know, investigated about chemical weapons and biological weapons, and while you are turning blind eye to what Israel has in this regard.
In recent days, world leaders have gone out of their way to try to defuse the tension between the Bush administration and the Syrian regime, with George Bush's good friend, Spanish Premier José María Aznar, insisting there were no war plans on the horizon. But on the ground, the situation looks different. Today, U.S. military forces cut the Iraqi oil flow to Syria, and last night, Lebanon's pro-West Prime Minister Rafi Hariri resigned. More than 20,000 Syrian troops occupy Lebanon, and political analyst Jamal Tahat believes Hariri is moving to distance himself from Bashar Assad ahead of an American assault.
I think Rafiq al-Hariri is thinking that there is continuity for the American occupation to Iraq, you know, and this continuity will be in the direction of Syria. And as a politician and as an ambitious politician, he doesn't want himself to be connected with a bad situation.
Meanwhile, Syrian officials say there's no way they will crack down on militant groups like Hezbollah, Hamas, and Islamic Jihad, which operate political offices in Damascus. Businessman Bazal Burgan says that's the right decision.
Without Hezbollah, Israel would not have withdrawn from the south of Lebanon, which they have occupied for more than 10 years, 15 years. Benefiting out of the water resources of Lebanon, diverting the Lebanese rivers into Israel, and making the security blanket, which was obvious, it failed. So they have the right, as much as the Palestinians do have the right to resist the occupation of Israel, because the major cause of the problem, you know, of the Israeli-Arab problem or the Israeli-Palestinian problem, is the occupation. You end the occupation, you withdraw. You do not stall or delay or play around withdrawal. You know, you get suicide bombers. And you get...
Israeli army troops shot dead a Hamas activist in Gaza this morning, a day after the United Nations top human rights body condemned Israel for acts of mass killing and extrajudicial killings of Palestinians. The 53-member UN Human Rights Commission expressed grave concern at the deterioration of human rights and the humanitarian situation in the Palestinian territories. The declaration expressed special concern about the opening of fire by the Israeli army on ambulances and medical staff. The United States voted against the resolution. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Aaron Glantz in Amman, Jordan.
The 22-member Arab League this week called for an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council to help war-torn Iraq stand again on its feet and prevent more acts of looting and destruction brought about by the sudden collapse of the regime of Saddam Hussein. Arab leader Chief Omar Moussa said Arab countries will meet soon to reach agreements on how to deal with the post-war administration in Baghdad. Analysts, however, were skeptical that Arab states will manage to arrive at a consensus, especially after a pan-Arab realization that the almost 55-year-old body is now obsolete. Ula Ferwadi reports from Dubai, the United Arab Emirates.
The failure of Arab states to prevent an all-out war on Iraq and solve the Palestinian-Israeli issue has cast dark shadows on the Arab League, the only formal body that represents all Arab countries. Critics say that the organization is one of the victims of the war on Iraq, with the Arab masses realizing that the organization is now irrelevant. Abdel Fattah Tokhan is a well-known Arab analyst.
The Arab League is a very big wastebasket. The reason I call it that is that in all its buildings, in all the desks and all the drawers, there are hundreds of thousands of documents starting from the Arab Deference Treaty to all the economic agreements. None of these has been applied over the past 30 years, so there is no use in them at all.
Arab League Chief Amr Moussa said last week that the inability of the Arab system to deal with the Iraqi and Palestinian problems forces Arab administrations to re-examine this system and take into account new ideas to build a new Arab political and security order. However, Moussa's remarks were met by anger around the Arab world. Analysts and politicians agreed that the organization should remain the main representatives of the Arab people, but that major adjustments should take place to enable it to function as an umbrella that can coordinate unified Arab action. Saleh Gallab is director of Al Arabiya News Channel.
The Arab League did not fail. Arab countries did. The Arab League is the culmination of Arab efforts, and when Arabs fail, it is because they have differences and problems with each other, and not because the Arab League is a failure.
Galab suggests that the organization concentrate more on economic cooperation. One thing that weakened the League, according to Galab, also a former information minister, was placing so much importance on political cooperation while ignoring the other aspects.
I think we still need the Arab League, but in a different way than before. We used to think of the Arab League as a substitute of Arab unity. We wanted it to be a body that has the authority over Arab countries. The Arab League is a coordinating body between Arab countries, so even if what remains of the Arab League were only the economic, cultural, and social aspects, then that is good. We should foster these aspects.
Arab League Chief Amr Musa expressed anger over the current situation of Iraq and called on Iraq's ethnic and religious factions to unite. Many said that the League could have coordinated efforts to help restore order in Iraq, but the idea was never even mentioned by any official in any Arab state. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, this is Ola Farawati in Dubai, the United Arab Emirates.
And now, the radio satire group, the Christmas Coup Comedy Players, presents this skit on the mass media coverage by independent journalists at home.
We now take you live to Blandon Scooter on location.
I'm not sure if you can hear me. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
I'm standing in front of my television set here in a suburb in North Houston.
Could you turn down your television set?
Oh.
That's much better.
What can you tell us about the mass media coverage over the past 2 days?
Well, I studied my favorite media puppy dog, Dan Rather, over the first day. You often have to wonder, I mean, does somebody have some footage of him doing something with a minor or something? Because every now and then he says something human. He wants to tell the truth, but then he goes back to spewing propaganda. Is this just self-censorship? You know, you have to wonder, do they have something on these people? But anyway, the first thing that stood out in the coverage for me was the missile attacks on Kuwait City. Kuwait is where the invasion is being staged. Immediately we get reports that there are Scud missile attacks. Scuds are prohibited in the disarm you before we attack you protocols. So they keep saying, well, we don't know if they're Scuds. It might be Scuds, but they might be Scuds. It's not a Scud, but they might be Scuds. In any case, the first two fall in the ocean, and then the next two fall out in the desert somewhere. And we are shown very impressive pictures of craters in the desert. And then the next four were shot down by Patriot missiles? Right, I believe that. Scud missiles have a range of 187 miles, and within 187 miles of the Kuwait border is blank, nothing, desert. We're told, well, we couldn't tell where they came from. We couldn't find the launcher because, you know, they launch them and then the trucks go hide somewhere. And the guy who was watching the satellite got up to get a cup of coffee. So we couldn't really tell, you know, and come on. Scud missile attacks on Kuwait City yesterday didn't work for me. I'm sorry. Didn't buy it. Back to you, Chris.
Thank you, Brandon. Press Secretary Ari Fleischer shed hopes on the struggles of the Basque, Tibetan, Palestinian, Chechen, Kashmiri, Taiwanese, and American peoples today in his briefing on the futures of freedoms for the human beings in this world.
It is mankind's nature to want to be free, and the Iraqis deserve that just as much as anybody else on this earth deserves that.
This comes in contrast to his apparent understanding of the meaning of record numbers of protests being held in the countries claiming to support this coalition's force now working in Iraq.
All told, the population of the Coalition of the Willing is approximately 1.18 billion people around the world.
In addition, Fleischer placed new trust in the ability of the press to get the story straight, ignoring the long history of fooling the press during times of war and peace.
The fact that you have as many reporters as you have on the ground are able to watch events live with your own eyes, I think you know that any attempts to do anything that would be said to be lies would not possibly work and should not be done. I think you will see information develop for yourself firsthand. This is one of the reasons that there are so many reporters present with the military. In many ways, you will have these answers yourselves. You are there. You are on the ground. And you will find the answers, and they will speak volumes themselves.
This comment stands in contrast to those made also today by Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld.
And what we are seeing is not the war in Iraq. What we're seeing are slices of the war in Iraq. We're seeing that particularized perspective that that reporter or that commentator or that television camera happens to be able to see at that moment. And it is not what's taking place. What you see is taking place, to be sure, but it is one slice, and it is the totality of that that is what this war is about and being made up of.
If you want your intelligence insulted by mass media, watch their coverage of protests. Puppy Dog Dan Rather did not disappoint. Protests were described as sometimes violent, an indication that protesters were sporadically beaten by police. But as Dan covered the massive demonstration in San Francisco, he commented that San Francisco had a spiritual and bohemian connection to Greenwich Village in New York City. And he pointed out that the streets in Greenwich Village were practically empty. Then, with editorial conjecture, Dan ruminated that perhaps that was because the people of Greenwich Village had experienced being attacked, unlike the people of San Francisco. However, it is possible that the streets of Greenwich Village were quiet because the residents had gone to Times Square to attend a demonstration. Dan! This is Blandon Scooter reporting from in front of my television set in a Houston suburb.
The radio satire group The Christmas Coup Comedy Players is produced at Pacifica Stations KPFT in Houston and WBAI in New York. Without your financial support, Peace Watch will cease to exist as of May 1st. It's your financial support that makes this program possible. We urge you to pledge your support through our secure online website at pacifica.org, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We'll be back in a moment.